If we just go after happiness in this life, if that's our only pursuit, then we have really ripped ourselves off.
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. Our hosts are Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. Jack is a philosopher by training, but his real passion is the Bible, having studied and taught it for more than 25 years. He is currently on staff at Mackenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College in Eugene, Oregon. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist, having practiced in California and Oregon for over 20 years. She is employed by the Caris Foundation, a teaching and counseling ministry. In this series, titled Being a Christian, Jack and Christine discuss the most important biblical concepts of the Christian life. Now, here are Jack and Christine.
In the last many weeks, we've been talking about Christianity at work and relationships. We've talked about Christianity at work in submission and headship, in marriage, in singleness, in divorce, all sorts of relational topics. Today we're going to open up a new topic, and we're calling it Being a Christian, Understanding Key Biblical Concepts. So Jack, could you talk a little bit about why we decided to go in this direction and what we hope to accomplish here?
Yeah, it may seem surprising to people that one of the problems of our present day is that there's a great deal of confusion, I think, about what our faith really is, what Christianity is. I think sometimes a lot of people have the idea that Christianity has been around a long time and we've kind of figured that out and we went to Sunday school and they taught us what it is, and now it's just a matter of getting on with how do we live our life as Christians and deal with some of the questions there. But if we're really going to take seriously the title of this program, Christianity at Work, one of the huge components of that is Christianity. You know, what is it? Do we have a clear picture of it? Do we know what it means to be a Christian and to live like a Christian and to think like a Christian or not? And what I would argue is that there are dozens or maybe even hundreds of different conceptions of what it means to live like a Christian. So if we're going to do our job to make clear for people what is Christianity and how does it enter into our everyday lives and go to work there and manifest itself there, then one of the things we need to do is get really clear on what Christianity is. And of course, our interest is biblical Christianity, the Christianity that is actually taught by the apostles in the New Testament. That's our concern.
So what we're doing is we're trying to go back to the basics and kind of try and throw away all our assumptions about what Christianity may be about and really look at some key concepts to help us understand how we work out our faith in relationship to those very fundamental issues in Christianity.
Right, exactly. What we're really aiming at in the end is not an intellectual exercise here. We really would like to paint a portrait of what it means to live and breathe and think like a Christian. The way we're going to go at it is to look at some phrases and ideas and concepts that you find in the Bible, particularly the New Testament we'll be looking at, and try to develop those concepts so that when we read through our New Testament, we know what it's talking about. I would imagine most people's experience in reading the New Testament is that it really doesn't mean much to them. You know, their eyes hit the words on the page and the word seems like an English word to them, but by the time they're at the end of the verse, they're really not sure what they've read. And that should be our experience because the Bible is a difficult book. It's ancient literature written in an ancient language that has been translated into English, but it's not just the language that's foreign. It's the whole way of thinking, the whole set of assumptions and background experiences, all so foreign to us.
Different historical context.
Absolutely, yeah. And so it's not like picking up the newspaper and reading it, and it shouldn't be that way, and we shouldn't be surprised or ashamed if we find that that's our experience. So what we want to do is try to help people nail some things down so that they have some place to start when they read the New Testament, and that way get a much better grasp of what is this thing that we say we believe, this Christianity.
I imagine there's a lot of people who are listening, like myself, who, when you say the Bible is a difficult book and that it should be difficult to understand, they kind of breathe a sigh of relief because I think a lot of us think, what's wrong with me that I just can't get this, that it's so difficult for me? And you're saying that it is a difficult book to understand.
Oh, it is. Yeah, and it would be dishonest to pretend otherwise. I have spent my entire life now studying the Bible, and only now am I beginning to finally think that I'm starting to break through and get some sort of idea of what it's really saying.
Jack, when you said you've spent your whole life studying the Bible, how many hours a week do you study the Bible? Or, and for how many years have you done that?
Well, it depends. You know, some early in my experience, I would, to prepare for a sermon or a class, would take me, you know, 12 to 15 hours just for a few verses. I'm more efficient and I'm quicker now because the more you learn, it's kind of like a snowball. You know, the once you get the little tiny core, that a lot more comes a lot faster. And that's been my experience, is that some of these key concepts are now a part of my own working understanding. And for that reason, it flows when I read the New Testament a lot more. But it's taken me, I've been at this since I started teaching the Bible at around age 20. And I'm nearing 50, so almost 30 years.
So hopefully we'll be able to glean a lot from that 30 years of experience and then be able to open the Bible ourselves, perhaps after this series, and have a greater understanding of what we're reading, see it with a lot more understanding than we have in the past, and see where it really fits into our lives. And that's kind of my responsibility, is to help us keep looking at it from a practical perspective, not just understand it in our heads, but see how it works out in our lives.
Yeah. Yeah, there's no point to just having an intellectual grasp of the New Testament if we're not captivated by the vision of life and reality that the New Testament gives us, it's all pointless.
Okay, so let's get on with it. Today we were going to talk about the concept of light. And I believe John chapter 1 is where we'll start.
Okay, yeah. It's called the prologue to the gospel. It's how John introduces the gospel of John. He says, in the beginning was the Logos, and the Logos was with God, and the Logos was God. It was in the beginning with God. All things came into being through it, and apart from it, nothing came into being that has come into being. In it was life, and the life was the light of men. And the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not extinguish it. If anyone actually has memorized that or was trying to follow along with that, I changed a couple of things, I think, to make it more accurate to what John is actually saying there. But we can talk about that later if you want. The thing that I want to focus on is this really kind of cryptic comment that he makes, and this life was the light of men. It's not at all obvious what that means, I think. And that's what I would like to kind of come to understand today, because I think it's an absolutely fundamental and important, crucial idea to have. Otherwise, we can't understand our faith at all. There's two issues. What is this life that he's talking about? And we'll get to that in a second. And the other idea is, what does it mean for something to be the light of men? Light is used not only in the Bible, but in all of ancient literature. Of this time, as it's a very pregnant metaphor that's used in a lot of different ways for a lot of different things.
In that culture, both in the Bible and in other literature?
Yeah, like Greek philosophy or Greek mythology or Greek literature. It can be goodness. It can represent goodness. It can represent truth. It can represent happiness, fulfillment, and probably more that just slipped my mind at the moment. But it's not easy to pin down. It really depends on the context, what the particular writer had in mind when they use the concept of light. I'm convinced that in this particular context, what John is using it to represent something that's very hard to define. But the closest we can come to it, I think, in English would be something like fulfillment. Let me get at it this way. Aristotle wrote a work that's called Nicomachean Ethics, a book on ethics that he wrote to a young man named Nicomachus. And in that work, he starts that work by saying, in the final analysis, what is it that we all want as human beings? What is it that we're all after? And he surveys all the Greek philosophy of his time, and he says, you know, there's one thing that all of them can agree on. There's a lot of disagreements among them, but there's one thing that they all agree on, that what we need to be aiming for in life is what he calls in Greek eudaimonia. Oftentimes, eudaimonia is translated into English as happiness. I think that's a very unfortunate translation. It's more like, there are other philosophers have defined it as human flourishing. I prefer to translate it something like fulfillment. And what he's saying is just, there's something very intuitive, something very instinctive. Isn't it the case that all I want in life is to be, is to have a rewarding life, a fulfilling life, a life that is full rather than empty, a life that's substantial rather than insubstantial? Don't I just want to be something significant and not be a complete cipher, a complete nothing? Or one way to put it is, don't I want to just be happy? The problem with happy, of course, is that has all kind, there's all kinds of different pictures of happiness that we can have. But we can put it that way, and legitimately so, is if I can just be happy, that's all I want. I just want to find the way to happiness.
I guess what I'm hearing as the difference between happiness and fulfillment is happiness sounds a lot more lightweight.
Right.
One-dimensional. As opposed to the many facets of fulfillment, there's a lot more depth there, a lot more filling out than there is with happiness.
Exactly. And the other problem I have with happiness is that particularly in our culture, maybe this wasn't always true, but particularly in our culture, we tend to equate happiness with pleasure and feeling good and, you know, good feelings. Whereas fulfillment...
Kind of just serendipity. Always smiling.
Yeah.
Always having fun.
Right. Whereas fulfillment, I mean, in the end, living a life of lightness and fun and good feelings could get awfully boring. And I think we all know that. That you know, what if you spent your whole life being happy, that is, feeling good, and there was no substance to your life? Would we choose that? Most of us, if we're at all thoughtful, wouldn't.
You know, it really makes me think about, probably three or four people in my counseling who have come in specifically saying, what I want you to do is just make me happy. And that's my goal. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the counseling, they have said, wow, we've really defined what happy is for me. I thought I just really wanted to feel good, but I got something a whole lot bigger than that.
Right.
I have gotten life and real fullness, or at least I can approach life much more fully and work toward a fuller life than I ever conceived of when I walked in here. I just wanted to get rid of feeling bad and having my life feel all good all the time, smiles all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think this very concept is crucial, particularly to our culture, because our culture has completely lost touch with this. It's almost unthinkable to us that someone would choose to be a creature before God who is what God intended them to be, who is what God created them to be, instead of feeling good. I mean, that is almost unthinkable to us. And yet, I think that's exactly the way we need to begin to think about our lives. It's far more important that we learn the truth about ourselves and live in the light of that truth about ourselves, and in doing so, become substantial, full, whole, meaningful people, meaningful creatures, rather than be empty feel-gooders, empty nothings that feel good. And yet, you know, at the drop of a hat, most people in our culture would choose the feel-good over the being people of substance.
And what we're doing is we're kind of ripping ourselves off when we just want that lightweight feel-goodness, when we miss out on the substantive life. Because it is, would you agree, that is out of really working toward a substance in life that we end up with the deep feeling of satisfaction, of goodness, of wholeness, and even sometimes happiness that it flows, it is the fountain out of which happiness flows, but not happiness out of giddiness, but more, I guess I want to use the word joy, more fullness of feeling than what we think of as just happiness.
Yeah, precisely. And that, I think, is what Aristotle meant by eudaimonia, that deep, profound joy, that deep, profound satisfaction that you're talking about is what Aristotle called eudaimonia. And he says that's the point of all ethical knowledge. We're trying to find our way to eudaimonia. We're trying to figure out how to get there. And what we normally go for in terms of happiness is to short-circuit all that. It's a shortcut, and we're taking a really bland flavor of happiness instead of the deep, rich, textured, full feeling of happiness that we could have if we learned the truth about ourselves and became the people that God intended us to be and created us to be.
And I think, Jack, the stumbling block, though, is that happiness is, we think, a whole lot easier to get to. If I just take a drug, if I just go to Disneyland, if I just marry the right person, if I just have the right affair, if I just have the neatest house or biggest house or prettiest car or whatever, then I'm going to be happy. And the kind of fulfillment that the Bible's talking about here is a whole lot more work than that. It really takes a looking at our life in a totally different way and working towards something rather than having it now.
Right, precisely. And I think technology is our enemy here. Technology has given us one drug after another, one distraction after another, one device after another to just allow me to have this kind of superficial surface feeling of happiness, pleasure. And I spend all of my life with pleasure and never tap into true fulfillment. I never find my way there. I don't have time. I'm too busy being distracted. And I think our culture is a deadly culture in that regard.
Over the years, the teachers of McKinsey Study Center have offered many classes, from studies in the book of Romans and Revelation to a biblical view of history and culture, to sexuality and relationships. McKinsey has also presented conferences ranging on topics such as education, evolution, and the arts. Most of the lectures and discussions are available on tape and can be purchased for a modest fee. McKinsey also has a tape catalog to help you make your choosing easier. To order tapes or get a copy of the catalog, call McKinsey at 541-485-4801. Now, here again are Jack and Christine.
Lots of times when people think about Christianity, and certainly I did when I was first a Christian, it was kind of like a killjoy. It was what I was, all the things I was going to have to give up and not have. And you know, if I wanted to be a Christian, it was just such a sacrifice. And in a sense, it is. It is giving up having all the things we just talked about as the focus of my life. But paradoxically, in giving those things up over time, I've gained so much more than I ever could have had by those things. And that's a perspective I think is really important to share, particularly with young people who are just new in their faith or people new in their faith. That isn't really what it's about. It isn't about giving up. It's ultimately about getting far, far more.
Yeah. But it is, that's true on the one hand. On the other hand, it is about giving up superficial joys for the sake of more important joys. And it is saying no to things that the rest of the world is going to run toward with abandon because they are distractions or because they are perversions or because they are lesser goods that are going to prevent me from pursuing the greater good. We do have a choice to make here. And it's important to realize that the choice that we're making, that we're not choosing to go the way that the rest of the world is going. We're choosing to go in what the Bible calls a narrow path. We're going to be one of the few who goes this way toward true eudaimonia rather than the superficial pleasure that the world pursues.
At a cost.
And it cost me that, yeah.
It's a cost and it's a gain.
Yep.
But we have to change our mind about what the gain is in order to really truly appreciate it.
I think that's what Jesus was trying to say when he said, unless the seed go in the ground and die, it cannot bring forth life. Until we die to the superficial, we cannot live to the profound. And that death to the superficial is very real to us. Everyone around us is making their life consist of all these superficial pleasures. And it just seems like a kind of suicide for me to not make my life consist of those same superficial pleasures. So it seems like a kind of spiritual suicide. But that's what Jesus is saying, is that that superficial suicide is what you have to go through in order to gain true life, life indeed.
Well, let's get some examples of this. What, can you come up with one?
A big one that I struggle with. I don't think I've conquered it, but one that we all struggle with in our culture is materialism. Just having stuff and owning stuff and enjoying stuff. It's so available to us, and we are so wealthy, and we are so capable of going and getting it. And there's so much joy at just buying and having new things. And
it's very seductive.
It's very seductive. Of course, in and of itself, it's neither here nor there whether we own things. It's morally neutral in and of itself, but it can become a real hook that drags us in a certain direction and gets such a strong pull on us that we cannot deny ourselves. And yet God may very well come along at times in our life and say, look, it's either me or the stuff. What do you want? Do you want me or do you want the stuff? And if the hook is strong enough in us, that's a hard choice for us. God, don't take the stuff away from me. Don't make me give it up. And yet it's going to burn. It's gone. It's out of here. It cannot bring me any lasting fulfillment. It can't even really bring me any lasting fulfillment in this lifetime. The car that I just had to have today, I'm bored with in a few years. The clothes that I just had to have today and brought me such joy and delight today look drab not many years later.
Well, let's look at this in more practical terms, using your example of wealth or your example of having things. If somebody was to drive down your driveway or my driveway, what they would see is two beautiful gardens and two beautiful houses. Mm-hmm. Both of us have some nice possessions. They might say, Jack, I don't understand what you're talking about. On one hand, you're saying that we need to die to having things, and yet you have such beautiful things.
Well, two things. One, as I say, I'm not convinced that I'm free of the love of stuff. I'm a product of my culture. That I often fear and worry, do I love my stuff too much? But there are two things, two battles that I fight in my life. One is, every now and then something is taken away from me. Every now and then something that seems important to me is destroyed or stolen or taken or lost for one reason or another. It's very important at that point that I battle the battle. How do I respond to that? God, has life itself been ripped out of my hands? If I say yes to that, then I was blind to an idolatry that existed in my life. I was giving too much weight to something in my life that shouldn't have any weight at all. That's not my happiness. That's not what my life should consist of. And God graciously and mercifully is reaching into our lives and ripping stuff out of our hands every now and then, just to remind me, this is not life, Jack. This is not where it's at. And it confronts me one more time. I have to reassess, and I have to take stock and decide, okay, now wait a minute, why am I here? Why do I exist? What do I want? Where do I want to go in my life? And it's important at those points that I get the answer right, that I not say what my life was all about was that possession, and I cannot be happy now. If I respond out of self-pity and despair, then something is desperately wrong. But if I can really genuinely from the heart say, God gives and God takes away, then that's the perspective of wisdom that we really need to have.
And I don't say God gives and God takes away. You're not saying in a very light way a denial of the reality of the suffering that you're going through. It could be very difficult that your house burnt down and there's no way for you to replace it. You're going to be feeling sad. You are going to have a lot of emotions that arise out of that loss. that's not what you're saying is ultimately the problem, that you have normal human emotions that rise out, that you grieve your losses and have difficulty with your losses. But ultimately, when the question comes down to, am I going to curse God because he took my home away from me, or am I going to say, God, you're still a loving and good God and I want to pursue you, that's what you're talking about. That's
right,
the question.
Exactly. Yeah. You really see two different kinds of responses when something fairly tragic and dramatic happens in a person's life. One person might respond, wow, if you're a God who would do that to me, I don't know if I want to follow you. I don't know if I want to trust you. Well, to whatever extent that question raises itself, or to whatever extent that question arises, to that extent, we really weren't clear what my life was all about. The other person, they may grieve deeply. I mean, it may be a real blow to the stomach, a real disappointment in their life. And that emotional response to the tragedy and the grief and the mourning that may happen, that's just human. I mean, there's nothing unbelieving about that. But a person can grieve deeply, but it never even occurs to them that they wouldn't want to trust God. It doesn't even occur to them. Well, that's a mature faith. That's a faith that has really been clear all along on what their life consists of.
And most of us don't have that kind of maturity of faith, and it is going through these deaths where it is matured.
Yeah, yeah.
So I can imagine that I might go through the loss of something that's very important to me. Well, I've shared this before on the radio, but I did go through a huge loss with cancer, thinking if I was going to lose my life. At that point, the question certainly was really big. Is God a good God?
Mm-hmm.
If he's going to take my life, if he's going to take my husband's wife and my children's mother, is that okay with me? And again, I know I've said this before, but it was a very profoundly important turning point in my life where I did ask those questions and I came up with the answer, God's still a good God. And that was a hard test to my faith, but it was very fulfilling, as we're talking about here with this concept of, I don't know if I can say the word, eudaimonia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It made me see life from a new perspective, and it did mature my faith such that when I go through, I can face other losses, and the question is so much more settled for me. Of is God good? Do I want to pursue God? That question doesn't come up as it has before. And I still, of course, grieve a great deal of loss in things that I really want. I was, for example, talking to a relative of mine who I very much love and want to love me back, and I want this person to admire me and respect me. And this person simply doesn't. And thinks that I'm, as a Christian, really going down the wrong road. Our values are very, very different. And for me to pursue these values, I will never have the kind of respect from this person that I would really love to have. Well, that's a death for me. And it's having to give up really very, very important relationship for me, and it causes me a lot of sadness, a lot of grief. It hurts that this person, either I give up what I think is important, or I give up really them having respect and love for me the way I would like it.
Yeah.
It's not a question anymore for me. It's that's the way it is. And I think that's what we're talking about here. That is a death to what would bring me immediate happiness. If I just would go toward what that person wants for me, I would feel happier. It would be a relief for me. But I would be giving up a fulfillment that is so much bigger, which I believe is in pursuing God and pursuing his values and pursuing his life in the way he's outlined in the Bible. And that's what I want, even as I have to give up things that are important and valuable to me.
Yeah, exactly. And you've put your finger on what is, I think, vital for people, to Christians in this day and age, to understand. The fact that there would be a joy, a delight, a profound sense of well-being and wholeness when, in the midst of battling cancer, you could finally conclude, yes, it would be okay with me if God were God, if God exercised his right to decide whether I live or die and how this reality is going to go. You know, you were talking about a sense of, I can't remember what language you used, but we could call it a peace, a sense of wholeness, a sense of fulfillment, or so on. It's very, very difficult to articulate it. If we have never experienced it, we don't know what we're talking about. But the joy, the eudaimonia, the happiness, the fulfillment that I think God created us to experience was that wholeness that comes about from being rightly related to God, from finally figuring out, who am I in this universe? How do I fit? And how do I relate to it? That when I am rightly related to God and his creation, there's a deep, profound sense of fulfillment and wholeness that comes from that, that is far better, far more substantial, far more enduring than any other kind of lightweight happiness and pleasure that we can pursue. That's what our existence is for, is to experience that on the long term.
So people might be thinking to themselves, yes, I would really like that. I'm sure there's other people listening to us saying, are you kidding? That's pie in the sky. I don't want anything to do with that.
Right.
They don't understand what we're saying, or they may understand it and not want it. But there's also people that are saying, yes, I want that, but I don't have that. How do I get that?
There's two answers to that. Ultimately, it's a gift from God. God is just going to reach into this reality, reach into my life, and he's going to take my life and turn it toward him. And I really don't have any control over that. It's God who is turning me to him. I don't turn to God. That's one of the biggest illusions of our culture, is that I could ever turn to God out of my own sentiment or out of my own spirituality or something like that. We're clueless. Our minds and souls and hearts are completely darkened. We are utterly shallow people, and that there could be no depth in us whatsoever if God did not put it there. It's just a gift from him. However, in terms of the way we relate to life and the way we experience life, how is that going to work itself out? It's going to work itself out as the suffering and grief and pain of my life raises the question for me, as it did for you, God, do I want you to have anything to do with my life? Are you a good God? Are you worth relating to? As I raise that question, to take that question on seriously and come to the right answer, to come to see that God is a good God and is my creator and is sovereign over me and all of reality, and relating to him rightly is more important than anything else that I can do. I just need to come to see that. And if there's anything I can do, it's just to take that question seriously and think it through to the end.
Take that question seriously and see, I think, suffering as the way that God is leading me toward understanding about myself, about him, about life. And that's a real hard perspective to take on suffering. We're going to be doing at least a whole hour on suffering, and probably a lot more at some point. I'd love to go into it now, but I think what I'd like to do is go back to this verse so we have a kind of a cohesive little unit of understanding here about this concept that you started with. So can you bring us back to this verse and bring all this concept of fulfillment into what John is saying?
Okay. So he says, life is the light of men. And the question I started with is, what is this light of men that he's talking about? I think what he's saying is, life, whatever it is the ultimate fulfillment, the deep and profound fulfillment of mankind, of humanity, of the human being. That which fulfills human existence in the way that God intended human existence to be fulfilled is this thing that he calls life. The biblical view of things is that this world is not just this kind of random, chaotic existence that just is, and we're to somehow find some meaning and purpose in it or create some meaning and purpose for it. It comes to us with a purpose. God created it with a purpose. History has a purpose. My life has a purpose. All the events that happen in my life have a purpose. But my humanity itself, my who I am, what God created me to be with all of the capabilities that I have and all the tendencies that I have. It's all aimed at something. It's aimed at some goal, at some, what the Greeks would call some telos out there, an intended goal to be reached. Well, what is the intended goal to be reached by a human life, by a human person? Well, whatever that intended purpose is this eudaimonia that John is trying to capture with the phrase, the light of man. God intended me to find this light, to arrive at this light. I think we could picture it. You're an ancient person back in the old days when they didn't have any streetlights and neon lights, and you're out out in the wilderness traveling, and you see a light from a village in the distance. The light is the thing that I want to head toward. That's where I want to go. That's what I have to attain, is that destination. And it's the light out there that is drawing me. It's signaling the way. It's marking my destination. That's I think, the sense in which John means this. Life is the light of man. Here I am, a human being. I have some freedom here. I can make some choices. I can go wherever I want to go, in a sense. Where am I going to go? Well, God has set a light out there in the distance, and he said, this marks the spot where you really want to get to. The real rest and solace that this weary traveler needs to enjoy is at that light. I can go any other direction, but it would be crazy to go any other direction, because God has created me to arrive there, to find that spot. That's sort of the imagery, the metaphor that I think is behind this thing. So, in this lonely, dark, confusing world that I live in, where do I need my life to aim? Well, at this thing called life. If I can get there, I'm going to find everything that my heart longs for, everything that my heart desires, everything that I was made to find is going to be found there. I think that's what he means by the light of man.
So what you're saying is that, let's go back to light, that's the fulfillment. So my fulfillment is in finding this thing out there, this spot, arriving at this goal. What is this goal?
Well, I'm sorry, I've confused you a little bit. The light is the goal that God, who is our creator, intended to be the final product or the final result of my existence. I think that's what the light represents. And then what he's saying is, and then the question is, okay, what is that goal? What did God intend me to arrive at? Well, he intended me to arrive at, and I think there's two answers to that. He intended me to arrive at life, which we haven't defined yet. But what I'm arguing is that's the same thing as what Aristotle said. He intended me to arrive at true, profound fulfillment, eudaimonia. He intended me to arrive at this thing that is the unique and prepared fulfillment for my existence. The thing is that in my freedom, I could go somewhere else. I could try to find my own kind of fulfillment, a different kind of fulfillment, a different flavor of fulfillment. Or I could just throw fulfillment to the wind and pursue something else, I suppose. Although I'm not sure that we ever do that. We're always looking for fulfillment, but we're looking for it in our own way. But what John is saying is, true fulfillment is to be found in what God created me for. And what did he create me for? He created me for this thing called life. That's where true fulfillment is going to be found. So light is just the destination out there, the thing that should draw me, the thing that is my ultimate good, because the good God who created this world created me for a particular destination, and the light out there is the destination that God has created for me to aim at.
So what I was doing was mixing up the concepts of light and life. Let's look at then the concept of life.
Okay. By life, I think John means here what elsewhere he means by what he calls eternal life. Now, that needs some explanation. The word that's used for eternal life isn't really, strictly speaking, literally eternal life in the sense that we mean that in English. The word that's translated eternal comes from the Greek word aion, which means an age. And there's two ways that John in particular describes this life. He calls it ionic life. I mean, to just take the Greek word and anglicize it, ionic life, or life of the Ion of Ions, that is, life of the Age of Ages. That's a phrase that he'll use sometimes. In order to understand that, we have to understand what view of reality he's speaking out of. His view of reality is that the whole history of the cosmos and the whole history of human beings can legitimately and validly be grouped into what he calls ages. There's this era, this time, when this is happening, and then God begins to do a new thing. A new thing happens in the cosmos where then this is happening, and then something else happens where this is happening. Well, from the biblical perspective, we live in what we might call the present age right now. But there's going to come a time where this whole present age is going to be done away with. The New Testament talks about the earth being destroyed, the heavens and earth melting like wax and basically being trashed and reduced to nothingness, and God will create a new heavens and a new earth. There's going to be a whole new creation, a whole new cosmos, a whole new thing happening. And when that occurs, that's going to be a whole new age. There's going to be some continuity between this age and the next, but everything is going to be made new. Everything is going to be made different. That'll be a different age.
So the age that he started in Genesis will be over, and a new Genesis will happen.
Precisely, exactly. From a biblical perspective, one of those ages, namely the one that's going to follow this age, is going to go on forever and ever and ever. It's going to be everlasting. It's going to be eternal. That age is never going to come to an end.
This age
does come to an age. That's the last age, the final age, or what John calls the Age of Ages. That's going to be the Age of Ages. Well, that Age of Ages has, in God's scheme of things, there's a certain kind of life or existence that he has planned for that Age of Ages. It's that life, it's that existence that I was made for. The life that I experience in this world is not good enough. It's not rich enough. It's not the right kind of life to fulfill the longings of that I feel in my heart. My heart longs for something that this world cannot possibly give me, it cannot possibly supply. And that's why the Bible, for example, in Ecclesiastes, looks at this world as a futile existence. This world, this age, is disappointing. It's empty. In Ecclesiastes, he says, emptiness, emptiness, all is emptiness, or vanity, vanity, all is vanity, or literally breath, breath. It's all just so much breath.
It's so lightweight.
It's lightweight and insubstantial. Yeah. I really want something more, something meatier, and nothing in this existence can supply it. Mm-hmm. But there's another existence coming. In the Age of Ages, there's a whole different existence that is life with a capital L, life with substance, life with meat on the bones, life that's really going to fulfill the longings of my heart. And there I will truly be fulfilled. There I will truly come into my own, and I will be a substantial person in a substantial world experiencing a substantial life.
Let me tell you what happened to me when you were describing that. I was thinking about it as being a new Genesis, a whole new thing, and it seemed just so exciting to think about God recreating all of this and making it all good. And my heart leapt. Mm-hmm. It's the first time that's ever really happened when I've thought about this new age to come. But it was so full for me in an emotional way. I've never experienced that before.
Yeah. I think it's because for me, typically my view of heaven was that heaven is somehow less than now. It's going to last longer, but I'm giving up so much. I'm leaving family behind, friends behind, gardens behind, homes behind, all the stuff of this world that really is a delight, our gifts that God has given us. I go to heaven and I sit on the cloud and play a harp and hope that I play it okay. You know,
and it doesn't really sound that much fun to play a harp.
It does not. Yeah.
I'd rather, that's exactly how I've thought about it. You know, I like my husband a whole lot, and I'd really like to spend a whole lot more time with him that I'm given on this earth, and I really don't look forward to losing him, and we're really limited by our vision of what's going on in this world now. It's really kind of hard to imagine to be captured by what's going to be coming.
Right, right. Partly because we can't even imagine it. It's going to be so much bigger and greater and imaginative than we can imagine, I think. And it seems so remote, so abstract, so ethereal. It's just hard to get your mind around because the stuff before me is so vivid and so real and so present to me.
So tangible.
So tangible, exactly. And the kingdom of God to come is out there in the future. It's so intangible to me. But that's the challenge of this life, I think, is part of coming to wisdom is coming to see that future age, the life in that future age more tangibly, for it to become more vivid to me, more present to me, more real to me, and more a part of what drives me and motivates me and energizes me in this life. And that does not come easy, but that's what we need to do, is to let our eyes be opened to be captivated by the vision of that age to come, because that's my true life. That's my true fulfillment. That's what I was made for. And part of what I need to realize about that life is that it's not less than this life, it's more than this life. That's what we were saying earlier. It's more substantial. It's more real. It's fuller, it's richer than anything in this life could possibly be.
So would it be accurate to draw this parallel that just like my clients who come in and say, make me happy, Christine. That's what I want out of this counseling. And they don't end up happy the way they thought, but it was what they ended up with in their life was far more fulfilling, something they didn't even have a vision at all to understand. And that's what they got. Is that, in a small way, parallel to what we're talking about here?
Yes. I think it's exactly parallel. I think that's what we're talking about. What is going to be the substance of the age to come? I think it's going to be multifaceted. I mean, just like in this world, we have music and we have color and we have a wide variety of emotions, all of which fill up our lives and give us joy and give us delight and so on. I think that in the age to come, it's going to be even more multifaceted, even more textured than this existence is, not less so. There will be the delight to whatever our senses are, or whatever they consist of in that age. We will have delights to the senses in that age. But the thing that we're learning down here, that we're going to take with us there, is that the real core and heart and real fixture, foundation of my fulfillment in the age to come is going to be this thing that we might call righteousness, righteousness and wisdom. This being rightly related to God, this being rightly in possession of myself, knowing who I am, living within the bounds of who I am, being content with who I am, being a good person rather than an evil person, delighting in goodness rather than in evil, not wanting to rebel against God, but being overjoyed with my love of God, finding satisfaction in the knowledge of God. Those are things that I can begin to experience here and now in this life. And to that extent, I think the life of the coming age can begin to break into even this world here and now as I begin to develop a taste for what it will be like to be a creature rightly related to my Creator. I can start that process now, and that's real fulfillment.
So right on the edge of my mind, there's this verse that wants to come out and bloom here, and I'm not sure it fits, but it's, now I see in a mirror dimly, but then I will see face to face.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I know I'm probably misquoting it really badly, but can you help us out here? And is that what he's saying?
Well, I don't immediately recall the context there, so I'm not sure that I can confidently say what Paul is saying. But certainly that image is appropriate in any case, whether that's what Paul exactly meant there. Certainly that image is very appropriate, is that here and now I only begin to see the reality and the fullness of what life is intended to be only very dimly. But
someday,
I'm going to see it in full one day.
Yeah. Someday I get to really see it clearly.
Yeah.
In her News and Views article, Reconciled Enemies, Mackenzie Study Center staff member Nancy Scott examines the common Christian belief that spiritual maturity depends on pursuing a personal relationship or friendship with God. She argues that the test of one's relationship with God is not whether one feels in fellowship with God. Rather, it is how one answers the question, what are we going to do with the fact that God is in charge of our lives and we are not? She states, the choices we make about how we respond to the circumstances of our lives, and not whether we pursue friendship with God, will ultimately attest to God's working in our lives. Call Mackenzie at 541-485-4801 for your free News and Views article, Reconciled Enemies.
So Jack, what you were trying to do in this last hour was to help us all have a perspective on reality that is different than what we normally or what we easily have. The perspective is that we think we're going to get fulfillment through the things in this world, like wealth, like relationships, like just stuff in this world. And we think that will bring us happiness. We think that's what it's about. But what God is about is changing our minds about that. He wants us to go toward a new understanding of what life is really about. And that's what John is calling light. It is a fulfillment that is much bigger than what we naturally see.
Jesus said, "What does it profit a man if he gain the whole world and lose his soul?" And I think what he was getting at is, you know, if we go after and try to grasp and grab and wring all the juice of life out of the stuff that is here in this world and become sated with the delights and joys and pleasures of this world, and then we die, then it's all gone, then it's all over. What has the man gained? So he had some pleasure. You know, so he had some fun, as well as a lot of grief and pain and garbage as well. But so he had some fun. What's the point? He's dead. He's gone. He's an insubstantial person who has never found what it means to be a creature before God, who's never come to know God, who's never come to love God, who is eternal, who is permanent, who's there to stay, and someone that we have to come to terms with and we have to deal with. Who is the more substantial person? It's the one who's found his soul. That is the one who has come to know who he is, a creature before God, who's come to love the God who's his creator, who's entered into a process of getting to know this creator and understand his creator and who he is as a creature in relationship to him. That person has found something that's going to last forever. He's going to enjoy that and pursue that and relate to God in that way for to beyond the end of time. And most importantly, that's what he was created for. God created him for that purpose. And so only when he fulfills that purpose as being a creature who knows and loves God, only then will he enter into the depth of what makes him a whole, substantial, and therefore fulfilled creature.
And these are very difficult concepts to understand. It takes a lifetime of God maturing us, and he is the author of that maturity in our life.
Exactly.
So we don't expect that people will understand everything that we're talking about here today. It's a process that God takes us through.
Exactly.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program, or would like to know more about Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And we're also on the Internet. Look for us under Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College. The Mackenzie Study Center is a nonprofit ministry entirely funded by the generous contributions of people who believe in its goals and have benefited from its ministry. If you would like to make a gift to Mackenzie, it will be entirely tax deductible. Just mail your check to Mackenzie Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. If you would like to call and request a free taped copy of today's program, the telephone number is 541 541- 425-4801. Now on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of McKenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.